We know what you're thinking. I just want jeans that look great, feel great, and hold up. At Ariat, we've been doing some thinking too. We're thinking about fit that moves with you, no matter where the ride takes you. Durability that stands up to hard work, harder play, and comfort that never quits. And all this thinking, it's really just about more living. Now, it's time to stop thinking and start shopping. Find your Ariat jeans at Ariat.com or a retailer near you.
Hello friends, welcome to your Wednesday morning Ipswich Town Kings of Anglia podcast. The morning after the night before, life comes at you fast. Just a couple of weeks ago we were celebrating five games unbeaten and Town finally beating Norwich City, and we're sitting here this morning with Town having lost two on the bounce and just completely crumbled at home to Charlton, newly promoted Charlton. Mark Heath, Stuart Watson here to break that down for you. Should have mentioned, of course, this podcast proudly sponsored by Stardust Spirits and Molecular UK. But there wasn't a lot to be proud about on the pitch last night, Stu. You've talked and written at length already about this game. I was just saying off air that you were using words that we haven't heard from you for a while. What strong words in your verdict and your post-match kind of video with Alex. So with the benefit of a couple of hours sleep, how do you reflect on what you saw last night now?
Yeah, you're right. The tone of my output probably has stepped up a little bit off the back of last night. And I don't do that lightly. I think people who've followed me consistently for a period of time know that I'm not someone who likes to go too early on negativity and try not to sort of paint yourself into a corner and try and stay pretty level with it all. But that second half last night was embarrassing. And my hackles were up watching that unfold, and I completely understood the reaction from the crowd, who, let's be honest, have been pretty patient. I think, you know, during the Premier League season, other crowds might have voiced their annoyance more vocally. But there was an acceptance of where they're at. But no, last night was, that second half was not good and not acceptable, as Kieran McKenna acknowledged afterwards.
We'll briefly review the game in a minute, and then I want to get kind of into the wider themes emerging from. But by way of kind of asking you a question around the manner of the defeat, would you say that this is the worst defeat of McKenna's reign? I know clearly there were a lot of defeats in the Premier League. Those were against, you know, world-class players and world-class sides, whereas this was against a newly promoted Charlton side. You know, in terms of the value of the squads, Town dwarfed what they were facing. And the manner of defeat itself was obviously melted like a chocolate teapot. So with all that added up, would you say it's the worst defeat of McKenna's reign so far?
Oh, put me on the spot there. I'm trying to think back chronologically. I would say anything in the kind of the early days of League One comes with the caveat that still getting early into his managerial reign and still getting his teeth into it a little bit. There were some frustrating days then before it all caught fire in League One, but I think we can probably park those in this conversation. Championship didn't really lose many games, did they? I can't remember how many they lost in the end. Was it
six? There was obviously that big defeat at Leeds, wasn't there, around Christmas time?
Which, yeah, was, I mean, that was the sort of the most comprehensive one in terms of being sort of outclassed, but it was low budget, newly promoted Ipswich against star-studded Leeds, and so it came with that. Probably the East Anglian Derby away game at the back end of the season. Yeah. Promotion just didn't turn up for that game when the stakes were so high, not just being a derby, but what was on the line in terms of promotion. Thankfully, that didn't matter in the end. And then, as you say, Premier League, putting aside the big defeats to Man City's and Liverpool's and people like that, there were some pretty deflating ones in there as well, wasn't there? I don't know. I'd have to give that a little bit more thought, but it would certainly be up there, I would say. The fact that it's at Portman Road, it's against a newly promoted side, it comes off the back of Middlesbrough, and there are some continuing themes that we're going to get our our heads around now, I think.
All right, and so in terms of the game itself, Town makes 7 changes, which immediately raises the eyebrows, but you're expecting some sort of rotation. And then, to be fair, they started pretty well, didn't they? And they had opportunities, although they didn't carve out loads of opportunities. Akpom hit the bar, Azon went close, other kind of half chances. I guess the big talking point from the first half was losing Alex Palmer. He's gone down with a muscle injury. And McKenna said after the game that he's going to have that scan, but you'd imagine he's not going to be able to play against his former team on Saturday. So that's a blow. Christian Walton comes in. But ultimately, having had all that kind of possession and stuff in the first half, then they just crumble in the second half and ship 3 goals in 12 minutes, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you want to start with the game itself?
Well, yeah, this is theme number one of the season, not killing it off when on top, not making the most of utter dominance. And it was utter dominance. They did start well in this game. They started on the front foot. I thought they moved the ball quickly, which is something that we've been calling out for a bit more. I looked at the stats. 10 minutes in, they'd had 90% possession. That's like training exercise type stuff. Mm. I think it had dropped to about 80% by nearly the half hour mark, but that tells you how much of the ball Ipswich dominated. And there were some moments in there. It felt like a matter of kind of when, not if, Ipswich were going to score. But were they ever really banging the door down? You have to give credit to Charlton. They defended really well. They played with a back 5-5-3-2, very solid, very organised. And their game plan was to soak up some pressure. More pressure, I think, than Nathan Jones was comfortable with. The very animated Nathan Jones on the touchline. And he said afterwards, you know, we were too passive. We were too respectful of Ipswich and we were giving their good players too much time and space to hurt us. And Ipswich didn't make the most and capitalise on that period in the game. I can remember, I think, Azon sliding in and not quite getting there ahead of the goalkeeper. Jack Clark had a corner that was sort of curling straight in that got headed off the line. Nunez didn't really have his shooting boots on. He had a couple of opportunities edge of the box that he didn't make the most of. And then, yeah, the Palmer injury comes around, I think, 20-odd minutes, goalkeeper change. And then there were some warning signs at the end of that first half. Charlton actually came off the pitch, probably having the better of the chances, and Ipswich didn't heed them. There was a sliced volley at the back post on 35. Looking at my notes, there was a one-on-one when Oleofe eased Young off the ball and Walton had to be sort of quick off his line. And then they really should score. It's a sitter right in stoppage time at the end of the first half when the corner gets flicked on and Gillespie somehow spoons it over from inside 6 yards. So, we get to half-time and it's not killed it off, not scored when on top. Some slightly concerning moments at the end of it. It's on a knife's edge. What are this team made of? And we soon found out.
Yeah, so there's another chance, isn't there? I think early in the second half, Akpom heads wide.
Yep.
But then essentially the collapse begins. And there's something about Town and Charlton and collapses, isn't there? We've had history with them, but certainly didn't expect it here. And the first goal, Stu, you have to say, and this is obviously a theme we're going to return to, defensively starting to look really, really weak, fragile. For a number of reasons. We've said all season that generally they've looked fairly comfortable in games, but then they've had these lapses of concentration or, you know, the odd mistake here or there, susceptibility to the long ball. And now we've got this concern about counter-attacking. But that first goal, I don't know what Dara O'Shea's doing. He's sort of just running back to his own goal. He's giving the guy way too much space, isn't he?
Yeah, and it comes from a direct, big, hopeful hoof upfield from the left back position, and it's Dara O'Shea who doesn't probably get enough clearance on his initial header. It lands at the feet of Carey and he picks up the ball. If you look back at it, Carey lands on the ball on the halfway line and then just carries it and carries it and carries it. And Dara O'Shea, maybe this is a system thing. Kieran McKenna talked about it, that Charlton go man for man. Committing too many men forwards in attack, which left too many spaces in defence. But Kerry had the freedom of the Ipswich half to carry the ball forwards. And Dara O'Shea, as you say, why he's backpedaling so furiously, I don't know. And Carey's eyes just lit up and he shifted it out to his left, drilled it under the goalkeeper. And what followed thereafter was not good. And this is the biggest worry of mine. It's when the chips are down, this Ipswich Town side aren't showing a great deal of personality and mentality and leadership at the moment. Someone who gets hold of the things by the scruff of the neck and says, no, enough now, making some good decisions on the pitch because, as you say, collapsed like a deck of cards and the crowd turned and the team folded.
That first goal, it's kind of similar in a way to the one they conceded against Derby. I think it was the second goal where O'Shea kind of half cleared a ball and then it just came straight back and he just literally ran through past O'Shea and scored the goal.
Yeah, the Brewster goal. It was virtual carbon copy, wasn't it? Yeah.
Let me just read you something, Stu, from your verdict. I mean, it's also worth, friends, if you are a subscriber, going and watching the video that Stu and Alex did last night, because Stu, at times you seem quite angry. You said the second half you found aggravating and frustrating. Let me read this to you. So in your verdict, under the header, embarrassing reaction, the biggest worry for me was the way Ipswich responded to conceding those three goals in the space of 12 minutes. Facing a cacophony of boos, the players did the absolute opposite of run towards adversity. No one stepped up as a leader. O'Shea and Greaves went to pieces at the back in their battle against two out-and-out strikers. They certainly didn't look like a nearly £30 million centre-back pairing. When Town won an 82nd-minute corner, no one seemed in any real hurry to take it. Nunes eventually sauntered over. When Jack Clark, the only Blues player to emerge with much credit from this one, drilled across through the box, there was no one there to attack it. The crowd, quite rightly, voiced their anger. There'll be a lot of talk now about how McKenna needs to change his system and tactics, either from the start or within games. Ultimately, for me, this collapse was down to deficiencies in mentality, personality, heart and desire, though. Pressure is a privilege, boys. It's time to fight for the right to party. Now, Stu, those are words we've not seen from you for a while. That's pretty strong stuff, I would say, especially given your kind of usually measured approach. But, you know, that's the sort of stuff we used to see back in the bad old days in terms of no leaders, crumbling. You know, that was always Town's problem, wasn't it? They just fall apart. They couldn't act pressure. Are we seeing signs that we've got the same trait in this team?
I don't know about that. I mean, look, it's up to them to show it now, isn't it? There have been difficult days in the past during this McKenna journey. And we've talked about it. This is a new team now going through new experiences. And they have to use this now, try and flip it some way into a positive as that can't happen again, and learn some lessons from it. We're talking about Charlton here. We had the 4-4 draw. You asked me earlier about, you know, most painful days under McKenna. That was up there, that 4-4 in that crazy stoppage time period. And they learned from that. There are other difficult days where they went for a spell of conceding late goals, the Cardiff game in the promotion season. They learned from that. And sometimes you have to go through pain to come out the other side. And the hope has to be that this group now uses this as a bit of a wake-up call. But it's not the first time. The reason I'm feeling maybe empowered to speak with this level of frustration is it's not the first time. Middlesbrough start the game really, you know, pretty well up at Middlesbrough. And then as soon as the first little bit goes against them in the game, just collective head loss. And that was that spell where Middlesbrough just carved through them on the counter time and time again, and Palmer got them out of jail. The Derby game, you know, they've got the game in the palm of their hands in that second half and somehow managed to have like a 10, 15 minute head loss or, you know, whatever period of game that was. So it's reactions within games. There is a lot of talk around the manager now and tactics, and I think some of those debates are valid and are worthy of discussion. But once you cross the white line, those players need to make some decisions for themselves, and some of it just comes down to football basics. And yeah, that was I didn't like the way that that, yeah, there was just, as I say, a bit of a collective head loss during that period, really.
And you say surely the most basic thing in football, or indeed in any sport, is going to be desire. You have to want it. You have to stand up and be countered. And although man for man, you would say this team, obviously better players, more expensive players than those double promotion winning sides, you'd never, ever doubt that from those sides. And I guess that was built through a period of having to face adversity, but it's just worrying, isn't it? As you say, the manner in which they collapsed last night against a team that on paper they should be beating every day of the week. Anyway, friend, should we talk about wider themes? The first one I want to discuss is the changes, and are we in a situation again? Going, I don't want to hark back to the good old days of the double promotion winning side, because that was entirely different scenarios. You know, plucky underdogs in the Championship, and that kind of spirit of wanting to do something they'd never done before, and this, that, and the other. Now you've got a team that's expected to do well, that should do well, spent loads of money, but that, going back to that promotion team, you knew what pretty much was going to be the starting 11 every week. Now, out of necessity as well as any other kind of reason, they're rotating because they've got so many players who think they should be starting, or, you know, being brought in for big costs. Do you think McKenna does know his best 11?
No, I don't think any of us do we? I think the first thing to say is that with the seven changes, I've done a predicted 11, I've done six changes. Alex had called eight changes. It ended up being seven. And I think if you'd have polled 100 Ipswich fans, 1,000 Ipswich fans going into this game, they'd have probably been in that sort of ballpark in terms of not only what they predicted, but what they wanted as well. There was a real clamour for Azon to make his first start. Obviously, Matasi was suspended. They missed him last night. His defensive physical attributes, but also I think, you know, some of his leadership as well was missing. And, you know, that's another conversation about, for all the recruitment and money spent, that's the one area of the squad that Ipswich didn't give themselves like for like backup in. But yeah, look, the depth can be a real super strength for Ipswich this season in terms of getting to 60, 70 minutes in a game, or tight games, which Championship games normally are, and subs coming on and grinding people down and making a difference. And we've seen some evidence of that so far. And hopefully come sort of the depths of the winter months, when the games come thick and fast and other teams start to really feel injuries and suspensions, that's where Ipswich will come into their own. But at the minute, it's also feeling like, as much as a blessing, it's feeling like a bit of a curse, because there's always going to be that temptation to rotate. These are all players that are used to being key men, starters. Mm. Persuading someone like Caden Jackson or Marcus Harness that their role is, you know, keeping standards up in training, always being ready, come on, make your difference off the bench. And having that conversation with them is one thing. Having it with probably people like Jack Clark or whoever else you want to name in this squad is a different conversation entirely. And good teams roll off the tongue, don't they? Successful teams, you can name normally six, seven, eight of them is the core, is the spine. And it's, football is not just about individual talent. It's about chemistry. It's about camaraderie. It's about being a team whose whole is more than the sum of its parts, and Ipswich aren't that at this moment in time. So it's a difficult one, isn't it? Because, you know, you lose games. Do you stick with what you've got and try and ride it out, or do you keep rotating? I don't know, but I would like to start seeing the core of a team start to emerge now. I mean, if I said to you, who are the nailed-on starters in this team, all being well, who is stamped into this team?
Well, who would you say? Matasiwa.
Yeah.
Leif Davis.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I would have said Jaden Philogene before last night.
Yeah.
But then he gets rested. He's, you know, obviously he's torn it up at Portman Road. I guess that the argument there would be rotating people.
Well, one issue which I've got is that they're two most in-form attacking players, both playing the same position, which is in Philogene and Clark. So, yeah, that's unfortunate in some ways. But Daro Shea's probably on that list of players. Palmer before the injury last night. But beyond that, there's not really anyone in the front four.
Kajusta, you'd say, I guess.
I wouldn't quite put him in that bracket at the moment. Okay. Kajusta, I think he's in a kind of rotation bracket with Nunez at the moment. He's a prime example. I think he sums up the start to this season, Jens Kajusta, someone who's had us absolute purring. It's not that long ago that we were on this podcast. You asked me, is he Ipswich's best player? And I thought about it and said, well, maybe from a pure football point of view, you know, he does look above the level in the Championship. Oh, he's so laid back. He's so smooth. He does everything. But is that almost indicative of Ipswich's kind of approach a little bit that, you know, we can just, we're better.
We'll breeze this place. Yeah.
And he's, you know, his levels have dropped. I don't know if that's a fitness thing, if it's a mentality thing, if it's just a form thing. But you can't just be good in games for spells. You've got to be good in games for the most of the match and be consistent game to game. And that's not something that Jens Kajusta has proven yet. We're 10 games in now, 11 if you include the Blackburn one, almost a quarter of the season in. Kieran McKenna's argument will be that the season didn't really start until post-transfer window because it was so late kind of putting the squad together. And I can see a bit of credence in that argument. But I think I said to you early on that I hoped Ipswich would improve and they would get better, but they couldn't afford to be sort of left chasing their tail too much. And that is the fear that scenario could very quickly blink. You know, it only takes a few weeks in the Championship and the table can start to look like it's going to be heavy work.
It kind of linked, I guess, into that kind of general conversation around best starting 11 and chopping and changing. You could link that in a way to the goals they're conceding because obviously they've changed the defensive pairings. You know, Greaves and Kipre have started. Daro Shea, who is the club captain and is an ever present, you'd say that he, you know, on form is not a man in form. So where's this come from, Stu? Because, you know, at the start of the season, I remember, actually, I think it was the Derby game. Me and Alex were sitting there going, God, Daro Shea, such a class defender, isn't he? Look at him. And then, you know, they can see goals through mistakes and lapses of concentration in that game. And that's been a theme all season, bad goals. But now they've added to that kind of looking wide open to counterattacks, you know, against pace. And the Borough boss said, Rob Edwards said, didn't he, after the game on Friday, expected there to be big gaps that they could exploit. And I think the Charlton boss said exactly the same to you last night, that he was expecting that. So, you know, McKenna, I think, said that's only been an issue in the last two games. But the general theme of them conceding bad goals and not being sound defensively is something that has been a theme the whole season.
Yes. Yeah. First goal always feels pretty crucial in the Championship, doesn't it? Ipswich need to be better at getting the first goal more often. Mm. And I hear Kieran McKenna talking afterwards that both these games could have been very different if they'd have scored the first goal at Middlesbrough. And obviously the Hurst penalty is the big moment there. If they'd have taken one of those chances in the first half in this game, maybe that would have, you know, looked like that Portsmouth match. And Ipswich ultimately sort of cruising to a fairly comfortable win. These are sort of parallel universe. This is ifs, buts and maybes, if my auntie, etc. So, there's different bits coming together. As I said to you post-Middlesbrough, they've not gelled as an attacking unit yet at the moment. Mm-hmm. Those patterns of play aren't telepathic yet. The starting 11 isn't stamped in yet. While they go through that process, they've got to get a more solid base and they've got to stop conceding these poor goals. And they have been poor goals. If you go through them all, sometimes you hold your hands up to the opposition, hell of a strike, brilliant team move, it happens, but I'm struggling to think of many goals against. It's, they've all been Ipswich mistakes, Ipswich self-harm.
So with,
that's got to stop.
With that in mind, do you now just say this is our best four or whatever? We're going to play those going forward because, you know, we've seen Furlong, we've seen Ashley Young, we've seen Ben Johnson at right back. Obviously, they've chopped and changed between Greaves and Kiprey as well in the centre of defence. Kiprey, after the Norwich game, we were all saying, wow, he looks amazing. And he scores an own goal against Borough and he gets dropped the next game. What's your thoughts on that? Is there anything that kind of stands out as well in terms of that is... that's what part of the problem is? I know Alex mentioned last night he'd seen sometimes the centre-backs playing too high up the pitch, that kind of thing.
I don't know, really, to be honest. If I did, I'd...
Yeah, you'd be a manager, yeah.
I'd be a manager, yeah. It's hard, isn't it? Because you don't want to be too reactive in football sometimes. Is there an argument that we're coming back to the tactical argument now, that do you go with a back three
to solidify
it a little bit, yeah, too much? Leif Davis leaving gaps at left back is certainly sort of an area of concern at the moment. The two centre halves, certainly when it's man for man and teams play two up front last night, are looking a bit exposed. There's an argument for that. He did it briefly in the Premier League when I think post the Newcastle home game leading up to Christmas, where they got done 4-0, changed to a back three for a period, and that worked to a point. If you remember, they went to Arsenal and limited,
yep,
chances off the back of that. That suited Wolfenden as kind of a ball playing centre half in a three, no longer with us, of course, but Kiprey could probably do that. We've seen he's quite calm on the ball. But then you're giving up everything you want to do as an attacking force. And it's how principled Kieran McKenna wants to be here. He believes in entertaining fans. He believes in playing with wingers. He believes in having plenty of attackers on the pitch and on the bench. I think that really went against what he wanted to do in the Premier League. That was only had to get really bad in terms of goals against for him to do that for a spell. And then in the end, he went back to 4-2-3-1. I cannot see for the life of me him suddenly switching to a back three and a solid midfield three of out and out midfielders and two up front, because they've not built the squad in that way. In football, it's always, how do we change the team? How do we change the tactics to fix it all? Ultimately, it's just got to be players playing a bit better and being a bit more focused and being showing a bit more heart when moments go against them in games. It sounds really simple, but I think that is the overriding factor here. Stop conceding rubbish goals.
Just do better football.
Yeah.
Sorted. Right. We'll see you next week. I mean, you're coming back to the kind of the personality of the side almost, you and the, you know, you leaders. Who would you say are O'Shea as the captain has to be a leader. You mentioned Matty Seaver already. Do you see anyone else kind of grabbing the game by the scruff of the neck? And
Not in a Sam Morsy style. And I don't want to keep looking backwards, but Sam Morsy not only led through vocally, through words, but he led through actions in terms of, when the chips are down, give me the ball. Give me the ball in a telephone box and I'll muscle someone off you and I'll turn 360 and I'll come away with it and just calm everybody down a little bit. And I think he was someone that had good in-game intuition. He was almost an on-pitch manager that felt, sometimes you have to feel when it's turning a little bit, you feel things in the crowd and you then know to say, right, this is when we slow it down, or this is when we speed it up, when there's a low block and there's a bit of frustration. Come on, we move the ball quicker now. We take a few more risks. And conversely, when when things are going against you and momentum is against you, right, come on, let's be sensible here. Let's, you know, call one or two more into shape and slow things down a little bit and take your time overtaking a free kick. We don't have to rush to get that goal back straight away. You need someone on the pitch to make those decisions. The manager can't really do much about it at that stage in the when things are happening within seconds, within minutes. We're talking about spells in games. Is anyone doing that on the pitch at the moment? Not in a Sam Morsi manner, I wouldn't suggest. The leadership group, Kieran McKenna's kind of wanted to keep that in-house. He hasn't sort of said who is in it. I think when you look at the team photograph that's gone out, you can get a pretty good idea because you can see who's kind of sat around the manager on the front row. Dara O'Shea, obviously, is captain. I would imagine Ashley Young is in there, obviously, with his experience. You know, I hope with him being on the pitch that that would be something, you know, the reason he was in there last night was to bring a bit of that calmness and leadership to it. But even he in that second half was sort of uncharacteristically making some loose touches and getting sucked into all of that. Matasi will be in it. I mean, we've heard from Leif Davis recently talking about how he now feels he needs to step up as a leader and has been asked to step up as a leader. But I don't know if that necessarily comes supernaturally to him. I think he's someone who leads by example, but, you know, certainly not in a typical kind of leadership manner, is he? So, those sort of attributes need to kind of emerge, don't they?
Yeah. The other thing about Moores is that obviously he was a great leader on the pitch and on game days, but also from, you know, various stories that we've heard from players who were in that squad. He was also a brilliant leader day to day, driving standards, you know, on the training pitch. We've heard from George Hurst clattering him on the first day. And I had people saying, well, he's being a bully there, Morsi. What is he picking on? But he's, you know, if you've ever been in a sporting context, you know that's challenging someone to stand up to you and kind of show their mettle and kind of that's the way you become part of the squad. And you wonder, is there anyone doing that? I mean, clearly we're speculating now, but that's what you need. You need that kind of leadership in a successful team. Just going back to tactics, Stu. Paul Merson, and I don't want to give him too much kind of airtime because I think sometimes he's got some what I describe as old school views around football. But he was saying after the defeat at Borough on Friday, they showed him too much respect. They didn't show enough respect. Town, they were too wide open. Do you think there's an argument there that maybe when they come up again, I'm not saying it would have been the case last night because you're not going to set up defensively against Charlton at home, but when they face maybe the better sides, is there an argument to be more defensively circumspect?
Yeah, there was an argument for the Middlesbrough game, certainly. Yeah. That sort of, is it a bit naive to try and go somewhere like that and be wide open and go toe to toe? The counter attacking part is really, I do agree with McKenna on this point that has only really started to become an issue of late. I think not just the last two games. I think Bristol City, I would throw into that mix as well. Even in the Norwich game, they had sort of some decent moments on the counter attack as well. So that is something that can't just be sort of, it's just a couple of games. It has been more than that. But prior to those matches at the start of the season, they were kind of moments out of context with games. And I'm not a big one for XG, as you know, compared to our colleague Alex, but the XG against did back up the eye test that Ipswich hadn't been conceding that many big chances in games. The goals against come from moments, from lapses in concentration, from one direct ball out of nowhere and someone making a mistake, whether it be Jacob Greaves with the penalty at Preston, or you mentioned the Derby County goals as well. But yeah, as you say, you're not going to, I don't think anyone could, even with the benefit of hindsight, say Ipswich should have set up differently going into that game against Charlton. You know, we're talking now a lot about the defensive deficiencies and the mentality deficiencies in that second half, but be more clinical in that first half and the rest of it doesn't follow. So Kieran McKenna's argument will be better probably at the first part. And then it takes everything else that follows out of the equation. And there is an argument around that. But as I say, while they're still getting there as an attacking unit, they've got to sort out the other part of things.
Yeah, and I suppose again, looking clearly, we spent a lot of time mentioning the promotion winning sides because that's a recent success. But I mean, they did concede quite a few goals, didn't they? Thinking back, but they were also clinical, and they scored a lot of goals.
Yes, they did, and that will then. I know now people will be saying, well, can Kieran McKenna set up a side to be solid? Can he set up teams to defend? Because as you say, they conceded a hell of a lot of goals in that championship promotion season, but were able often to outscore teams. And the games that stick in our mind are 3-2 against Southampton and 4-3 against Blackburn, and these high-scoring ding-dong affairs where we'll score more than you. But what people don't remember as much is they did grind out, they showed a lot of heart, and they showed that they could roll their sleeves up at times. And there was a lot of 1-0 wins on the road. QPR away, Southampton away.
Blackburn.
Bristol City, Blackburn. You know, there was a lot of games like that. Clean sheets. You know, it's what the old adage about attack wins games, but defense wins titles, etc., that sort of thing. Got to get themselves a solid base, and then the attacking side of things can flourish.
Right, Stu, 35 minutes in, we've been pretty how can we say negative? Is negative the word? Downbeat off the back of last night, and clearly it was a bad result. But there's always a danger of knee-jerk reactions in football. It feels like every game in football now is getting more and more kind of blown out of proportion, every result. But, you know, wider, bigger picture time now, Stu. They're 10 games in. They still have a game in hand. It's not like panic station situation, is it? Clearly, after a game like that, you look on social media and you've got people calling for all sorts of things, you know, which are objectively pretty silly. But the wider picture, we're not, as I say, it's not like, oh, panic, everyone.
No, I have seen, it's felt like any kind of McKenna out stuff has been limited to the extreme fringes up until this point. But last night was the first time that I felt that some of that debate has started to permeate into the more logical, reasoned part of the fan base. I don't think anyone in that field that I've just discussed is probably at a stage where they're really making a strong argument for it, but just starting to say, hang about, has the recruitment been at the level that's required now? And that is, I think we need a bit more time to fully assess that. I mean, last night, for example, as I mentioned in the bit that you read out, that's almost £30 million worth of centre-halves that's not quite looking like that at the moment. And there's other areas of the pitch. Why, as I said, the two best attacking players, both in the same position, £35 million on Clark and Philogene. Why did such a big chunk of the budget go on two players that, say, play in the same position? And so there's areas like that in terms of recruitment that can be looked at. Can he set up teams to defend? Have they conceded too many goals over a period of time? People now pointing out the number of wins over since the start of last season. Slightly unfair, because I think, you know, obviously Premier League season is a big part of that. As I say, I'm not going to, as long as people have those debates in a sensible way, I think, you know, there is a fairness to start having some of those conversations. It still feels a bit early to me. We're 10 games in.
It's fair to say, certainly, that, you know, he's got to sort it out. Like, you know, he's got a big challenge ahead of him to turn this round again.
This is a new challenge now. As we said, going into this is completely different to the last time they were in the Championship. This isn't underdogs with momentum. This is, these are the favourites. This is this target on the back. We're hearing every manager every week coming out with superlatives, you know, waxing lyrical about Ipswich falling over themselves. What a wonderful coach. What a wonderful manager. Brilliant players. But we're going to come up with ways to try and hurt them. And Nathan Jones sort of last night said, You know, I said to them, this is a great team, but let's really go up against them and see what they're made of.
Mm.
And we found out after, he said, after a dramatic pause. So teams are raising their game against Ipswich. They are changing their tactics. They are showing Ipswich a lot more respect. And this is where Kieran McKenna earns his corn. He's, you know, he became one of the highest paid managers in the Premier League last season when Ipswich saw off that interest and gave him a bumper new deal. This is now where he and the big money players and the more experienced players have to step up and show that's why they've been recruited and paid the money they are. I'm not going to hold back on. I try not to be too reactive to things. It's only a fortnight ago that we're all basking in the glow of a derby win and saying, you know, three wins from four, was it? An unbeaten spell and they've turned a corner and the new team's coming together and isn't this great? And now here we are having this conversation. So I don't want to get sucked into that too much. There's still a long way to go, but I think it's important that you've got to maybe see a little bit of trouble coming down the track. And I'm just fearful sometimes you think, was the good games the anomaly in amongst this? And you've got to try and see where the underlying themes are. Look, ultimately, Ipswich have won three games and two of them against Sheffield United, who were in absolute disarray, and the manager went afterwards, and Norwich, who are seem to be in a really dark spot at the moment as well. So I hope that's not the case, and I hope that this can be a sharp and a steep learning curve, because it has to be.
There is a danger, isn't there, constantly getting platitudes, people saying, wow, what a team, what players, you know, that kind of stuff. You start to believe that. And I guess it's almost like a different challenge for McKenna in the promotion winning seasons. He had to convince the players they were good enough. They could, you know, show they were good enough. And now maybe these players, he's trying to do the opposite. You know, you're not too good for this level, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that is now needs to be the general theme of the conversation, I would say, behind closed doors, is these lot think you're soft. These lot think that they can get at you. You need to prove to them that we're not just a pretty fancy playing team that, you know, want to play with, just want to dribble and pass. And, you know, you've got to show them that, you know, we've got a bit about us on the other side of things as well. That would be the topic of conversation that I would be leaning into now going into these games ahead.
There's a great saying, my granddad, I think I've mentioned it before, he used to be kind of what you call an early strength and conditioning coach back in the day. He used to work with Derby County and stuff. And he always told me, because I didn't have a lot of talent, he'd always say to me, hard work beats talent when talent doesn't work hard. Yeah. And that is an absolute truism, I think, in life and certainly in sport. If that talent is not up for it, isn't working hard, hard work and kind of desire goes a long way. Big challenge ahead for McKenna. All that being said, Stu, another big game at the weekend. They're all big games. West Brom at home. It's you know, a good opportunity to write things and get back in the winning frame of mind. And if they do win on Saturday, you know, this whole conversation probably changes again. And we're going, pretty good. They showed some character there. West Brom, though, what would you like to see in terms of team? Because this feels like a big game. For me, you have to go with your strongest team. And we've already said that maybe he doesn't know what his strongest team is. What would you do in kind of the contentious areas, shall we say, you know, Greaves and Kipre and Hurst and Azon and McAteer and Ageli and, you know, Philogene and Clark. I mean, that's an odd one, isn't it? As you say, the two kind of most informed players can't play in the same team.
Mark, I haven't got a clue. I've not really thought about West Brom an awful amount too much. I'm still sort of, you know, I watched the game last night. I left the ground gone midnight, got home, put my laptop on, I wrote that verdict. It was early hours of the morning, went to bed, woke up, immediately have jumped on this to discuss about it a little bit more. But
I'm not asking for a prediction. I'm just really asking you for you'd like to see play.
I know, and I'm trying to think on the spot what to do, really. Part of me wonders whether I'm just looking at West Brom while we're talking about what, I mean, they're 4-2-3-1. I think I would stick with that. as much as we're talking about maybe putting a bit more of a solid base in place, I think I would stick with that. And I would try and pick the players that you think in your mind are the ones that you really want to establish. And that means, if that means going with an O'Shea and Greaves again, then that means that. Furlong back at right back. Walton is going to be in goal again. That sounds like it's a reasonable calf injury for Palmer. Matasiwa obviously comes back in. I think you've got to go Matasiwa, Kajusta. You've got to try and play them two as much as you can together as a partnership. And then the front four.
Well, Philogene's got to come back in, surely.
Yeah, Philogene's got to start, but Clark was probably the only player that came out with any real credit from the game last night. I thought he was really good. I thought he was good in that opening spell when Ipswich dominated the ball. He was the one most likely to make things happen when the chips were down in the second half. He was the one that kept wanting the ball, kept wanting to try and take people on. So it would feel really harsh to take him out. But I'm not that keen on Philogene and Clark in the same side and shoehorning one of them in on the right-hand side, because they tried that a bit in pre-season and the balance of the team didn't look quite right. So that's a really hard call. But I think he may be tempted to do that, to be quite honest, because McAteer, he showed a bit more last night in the early stages, but probably not quite enough. I think I'd now try and stick with Akpom. I thought I saw some more signs of what he was about last night. Mm. I think you brought him in from Ajax for a reason. You've got to stick with him. And then up front, did Azon do enough last night? Or, you know, do you want to hang your hat on George Hurst and back him to play himself through a slightly difficult part of the season and go, we gave you the number nine for a reason. We believe in you for a reason. You've had a little dip out of the team, a little rest. Now go again. Tough call, that one.
I've seen some people saying, why can't Akpom start up top? I think there's any, I mean, Killy, when he signed, Kieran said he can play all four of the front positions and this, that and the other. We know he had this great success at Middlesbrough playing the 10.
Mm.
He has also played a striker. Do you think if they're even considering that, that's a massive kind of blow?
What would two up front look like for Ipswich Town? Charlton did it last night. Not many teams do in modern football, rightly or wrongly, but they decided last night that two up front and going man for man against the two centre-halves with power and pace, in Nathan Jones' words, was the way forward, was the game plan, and it obviously worked. I think that's something that sort of underdog teams tend to do more. You know, he said we can't be as open and fluent and free-flowing as Ipswich because we haven't got the resource or the talent. So you have to find another way. So would that work for Ipswich? They haven't got tons of out-and-out strikers on the books. But as you say, you know, they've got Hurst, they've got Azon, Akpom can play up there. What would that look like? It would be three, just thinking out loud, it would be the three centre-halves. So then you go O'Shea, Kipre at the heart of it, Greaves on the left-hand side. I could see that might work as a balance in terms of left-footed, right-footed, etc. Davis looks like he'd be well-suited to a left wing-back that can get up and down all day and has got a bit more security behind him. Central midfield, you'd then be able to get Matasiwa, Kajusta, and maybe then Nunez in as a kind of a, with the shackles off a little bit more as a playmaker. Then you could have your two up front, as you say, Hurst and Azon or Akpom could be one of those two. Right wing back would be the issue, I think, looking at that system. Probably the most suited to it is Ben Johnson.
He looks
way out of the picture at the moment for whatever reason, but I think he'd be quite suited to a right wing back role. He's not fully trusted as an out and out right back, but he's got the physical attributes to play as a wing back. But for whatever reason, he's kind of been jettisoned a little bit at the moment. I know he came on last night towards the end, but he's not been making match squads before then. That's how, in my mind, a kind of a 3-5-2 system would look for Ipswich. But I don't think Kieran McKenna's going to go for it.
No, I'd be massively surprised, but interesting to think about, isn't it, Stu? At the same time, have a little think about it. Okay, that brings us to the end of the kind of football section of the pod. Just want to, before we go, have to mention, obviously, a big fight for Fabio Wardley this weekend.
Sorry. That system that I've just outlined, of course, has no Philogene and no Jack Clarke in it. Who are the two?
Oh, yeah, good point.
Who are the two sort of in-form attacking players? And that's what it will boil down to, is that you're taking... You know, you've built a squad based heavily around wide individual talent, players that can do things. You switch to that. Yes, it might be more pragmatic and solid, but you're stripping away a lot of your attacking attributes. So that's where that falls down. But apologies. Yeah, Fabio, let's talk about something a bit more uplifting.
Yeah, good job we're not football managers, AC. yeah, Fabio Wardley faces Joseph Parker this weekend at the O2. Second time headlining the O2. And this, in the kind of spirit of his career to date, is again the biggest fight of his career, because he's facing the guy who's the second best consensus, second best heavyweight on the planet behind Alexander Usyk, who holds all the belts. And if he beats Parker, then in theory, Usyk would be the next fight. And Usyk has actually come out this morning, said he doesn't want to fight Tyson Fury again because he already whooped him twice. And frankly, I don't want to see that again, which would then lead the winner of this fight, you'd think, to be next in line for Usyk, which would be insane if that is indeed Fabio Wardley, given his background and the level that Usyk is at. So yeah, I went and did a little KOA special with him last week. There's a video on our YouTube, and also the pod went out earlier this week to listen to. Went and saw Fab looking very relaxed and chilled out, as he always is, very confident. Is there anything you'd like to ask me, Stu, about this fight by way of, or do you want me just to kind of carry on rambling?
No, I'm just going to say the floor is yours. Break it down for me. Look, I was there at Portman Road for the fight before. We know how that one played out, probably outboxed even as a layman watching on for the majority of that. But the power punch comes from nowhere, as it often does. What's this like stylistically as a fight for Fabio? Does it suit him more?
It's very similar, Stu. Joseph Parker is kind of similarly proportioned to Justice Hooney. He's not a massive heavyweight. He'll be a bit smaller than Fab, actually. But he's also, like Hooney, he's a very good boxer. He boxes well, he moves well, he's fast, puts combinations together well. Crucially, though, you would say that his kind of two big differences with Hooney is that he's massively more experienced. This is a guy who has been world champion, was world champion when Fabio, I don't think, had even started boxing. He was world champion. He lost his belt to Anthony Joshua. He's been in with a who's who of the best in the world. Parker, he's fought and beaten Deontay Wilder. He's been in there with Zili Zhang, who's a big power puncher. He's been in with Andy Ruiz, the guy who upset Anthony Joshua and took his belts. He's beaten him. On form, you'd say he's the most in form, other than Usyk, obviously, the most in form heavyweight on the planet with the people he's beaten. And he also, crucially, I think, he hits quite a bit harder than Hooney. If Fabio gets caught with the sort of shots that Hooney was catching him with, that's going to be trouble for him, because Parker has kind of fight-ending power, whereas Hooney, I don't think, packs a lot of power at the kind of upper levels. So it's a big test for Fab. He should be the underdog. It's a massive, massive step up. He's gone, in a matter of two fights, he's gone from fighting Fraser Clark for the British title to fighting Joseph Parker, the second best heavyweight on the planet, potentially for the next fight to be Alexander Usyk and all the heavyweight titles. Crazy story. So I would say that Fab is the underdog, but I would always say with Fab that you never can count him out, because he has that equalizer, you know, the most kind of important, what's the word, attribute, I guess, is power in boxing, you know, the sheer violence of it. And Fab has that he can pull out at any time, as we saw. He can lose every minute of the fight and still be dangerous in the final rounds, because he's got that otherworldly power, which will always give him confidence.
Finishing power and heart as well. We've been talking a lot on this podcast about that. He doesn't know when he's beaten, does he? He doesn't, you know, something in boxing, sometimes you see some people, they get hit and it lights something in them, and they dig deeper, and he certainly is. I mean, he's shown that he can dig deep, hasn't he, through his short but incredible boxing career so far.
That's a great point, Stu. He's a natural fighter, you know, on top of everything else. He's clearly extremely, you know, athletically gifted, given
the complete lack of amateur background. He's just a, you know, a natural fighter. I heard someone compare him to Nigel Benn in terms of being among Britain's most naturally kind of gifted fighters. And Nigel Benn, I don't know how much you watched of him, but he was a big one for me when I was a teenager. He was so dangerous when he was hurt. You know, Nigel Benn almost needed to be in a bad spot to become what he was. And then he had this remarkable power, again, like Fab, that he can clip you with either hand and take you out. So be under no illusions, it's a massive, massive ask for Fab. I think a lot of people think that Parker will just outbox him and maybe stop him or win on points. And he certainly should be the favourite. But, you know, as I say, you can never count Fab out. We've seen that time and time again. And if he can catch Parker has been dropped. He has lost. So who knows? And if he wins again, you know, the movie continues. And the thought that we'd have a guy from Suffolk who only started boxing 10 years ago to lose a bit of weight could then be fighting genuinely one of the greatest fighters pound for pound of all time in Alexander Usyk for all the heavyweight titles. That's if you saw that in a film, you'd go, that is ridiculous. That would never
happen. We're in Rocky territory here, aren't
we? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, 100%. So, yeah, really looking forward to it, but also slightly dreading it at the same time, Stu, because, you know, as much as we try and stay objective, I make no bones about it. I've followed Fab's whole career. I feel like he's a friend. You know, I want to see him do well. So it's always tough watching him fight. But yeah, that's on Saturday night. So hopefully Town beat West Brom. And then there's a bunch of players and Mark Ashton going to the O2, I understand, going down to watch Fab's fight on Saturday night. If you can't be there, it will be live on DAZN. I think the ring walk is set for about 10:30 p.m. So quite a decent hour. And actually, when we went down to speak to Fab last week, who should wander in to kind of say, oh, I'm up next? Wes Burns. To do a bit for Town TV. So I think, I'm not sure if that's out yet, but they were about to film something with Wes and Fab. So there we go. Something to look forward to there. Stu, I'm not going to ask you for a prediction for West Brom because clearly you've barely been awake since the defeat last night. And we are, 3 days away from the game. So I'll just ask you if there's anything else you want to mention before we take our leave.
No, I don't think so. Hopefully that wasn't too downbeat, too negative. I try not to go there too soon, but I thought last night that second half warranted it. That's not to say that the season is heading in a certain trajectory. There's no point us keep looking back to players of the past. This is the group now. Hopefully everyone can have a bit of a reset, players, crowd, us, over the next sort of 24 hours or so. And we go again. That's the beauty of the Championship. There's always another game around the corner.
Exactly. And as we've already said, if they get a result on Saturday, the whole thing changes again, doesn't it? The mood. Because that'd be a good win against a good side in West Brom. And God, they've shown some fighting spirit. What we do need to see, Stu, though, definitely is some sort of reaction, isn't it? That, you know, you want to see them flying out of the gate, really bang up for it straight from the kickoff on Saturday. Showing that desire, that heart, all that kind of stuff that you've maybe said you didn't see last night. And I think a lot of people would agree with you. Friends, just to remind you to support our sponsors, use the code KOA at stardustspirits.co.uk for 20% off all their excellent alcoholic beverages. And also our newest sponsor is Molecular UK. They're at molecular-uk.com where you can use the code KOA10 for 10% off all their cleaning products. And I've got a whole box full of them that I'm going to get bang stuck into to clean up the old Heathmobile and make it look a bit more respectable. Thanks for supporting us, guys. Always great to have Suffolk businesses involved. Also, friends, if you leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, that'd be great. Just lift us visibility wise in the charts and give us a follow on all social medias, Kings of Anger on YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, X, TikTok, and me, Rossi, and AJ all individually on Blue Sky. Friends, as Stewie says, I hope you didn't find this too deflating, but it was kind of a necessary kind of counselling group therapy session, I think, after last night. As Stu says, there's still lots of football left to be played, and that is the beauty of the sport. It will all get again on Saturday when Town will go again, and we'll be back again next week to break it all down, whatever happens. Have a great weekend. We'll speak to you next time. We'll be right back.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.